Sanitary Service Institute. The OSSI is composed of not only sanitary collection companies, but also landfill owners and operators. We have 19 landfills in our association, all the way from Brookings to Hermiston, everywhere else around the state. And I've talked with a number of my landfill operators, and as you know, as I've testified in previous times before this committee, one of our concerns is, in fact, in identifying those areas of the waste stream that represent particular hazards to our landfills, in particular those unregulated hazardous wastes, both household and small quantity generator wastes that we are presently finding coming into our landfills. And we have been very supportive of looking for ways to get those waste streams out of our landfills, because we know that we are going to have the long-term liability. We're not going to be able to go back and find John Doe or Jane Smith, who gave us a battery 5 years ago, and ask them to participate in the kinds of environmental liability that we may have. So we're interested in taking a preventative approach. And therefore, Representative Kiesling talked with me about this bill, and we do support anything that will even increase the pulling out of the waste stream, even an additional 10% of these batteries. We hope that this bill will result perhaps in some monies going to DEQ so that they can assist in ensuring that the recycling markets stay available and open, because under this bill, our landfill operators are going to be prohibited from taking those batteries after January 1, 1990. That's correct. 1991, I'm sorry. That doesn't give us that much time, a little less than 2 years, to make sure that there are other options available. So that is our concern. We don't want to be prohibited from taking the battery when we know that the option for that person is going to be to dispose of them completely irresponsibly. So we're interested in seeing that some of this money, as Representative Kiesling said, if somebody doesn't bring back a used battery, their $5 stays there and a dollar goes to DEQ, or however you decide to do that, that can assist in ensuring that there are other options available. I wanted to pick up a little bit on Representative Agron's question, and that is that under this bill, a retailer is not going to be forced to take back a used battery from someone who's not coming in to buy a new one. So you do still have that problem of what people are going to do with those used batteries. I had lunch with one of my landfill operators, the one that runs Riverbend Landfill, which is one of the large ones in Yamhill County. And I talked with him about this bill, and he said, one of our problems is we find farmers cleaning out, Representative Agron's is gone again, farmers cleaning out their barns. They got a lot of old batteries stacked up from their farm equipment. That's coming to the landfill. And while this bill can't solve that problem, because you can't take all those used batteries into the retailer, we hope that it will assist in getting a system in place that stabilizes the recycling market, so that there is some other option besides bringing them to our landfills. And we'd be glad to continue to work on any amendments and work with DEQ and any other assistance we can provide.
Sure. Representative Parkinson.
Diana, say during the period of time when there is a market for batteries, the garbage handler, the guy that throws on the truck, would pick them out. Isn't that correct? If they're worth $2 or $3, I'd assume he picks them out.
I can't answer that, Representative Parkinson. I'd have to talk to some of my collectors. I didn't do a complete survey of my membership to find out whether they pick and sort through that or not. Some may and some may not. If it's only one or two in a compact or truckload, that's going to be a little difficult. And I don't know whether any of my landfill operators try to collect those separately and try to sell them in bulk. I can inquire further, because I know we're going to have a later meeting.
I'd appreciate hearing that. I assume they do.
Right.
But you'd have dumpsters where they don't have the opportunity to go through anything, probably the bigger containers.
Sure.
Mr. Chairman.
President Weehan.
Diana, have any of your members ever expressed concern about the lead or the acid that's contained in the lead batteries? Has there ever been a problem identified with that because of...
I haven't talked with them specifically, no. They do definitely want to get batteries out. They have identified batteries as an area of concern. They haven't talked to me about specifically the acid in them. I will talk further with them, though. I wish I'd had one of them here. I'll have some of my landfill operators here on Wednesday on another bill. Take the opportunity maybe to find something more out about that then. I'll have several landfill operators here.
Any other questions? Thank you both very much. We appreciate your testimony. John Charles.
Just a few brief comments, Mr. Chairman. John Charles, representing the Oregon Environmental Council. We support the bill and we support the concepts that Representative Keeslin outlined. We'd like to make three comments about those. One possible variation on the amendments dealing with $5 deposit and potentially 20% of that staying with the retailer as a handling fee and 80% going on to the state. It would be possible to deal with the fluctuations of the eventual market, which is a very key element here, to authorize, say, the Environmental Quality Commission to examine that user or not user fee, the handling fee on a year-to-year basis. And if the market changes such that in order for the retailer or distributor who is accepting the battery to process it to a recycling facility and not lose money, that they need to recover 25%, say, instead of 20%, that the commission be authorized to change that amount over time to deal with the market situation. So that it would not be set. It would, as the facts of the case dictate, could be changed. That's just a potential variation.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parkinson.
I should quit asking questions. But if it worked like the bottle bill is, oh, there'd be no $5 anywhere. Would there? If it's a closed loop like the bottle bill? Phil was talking about that a minute ago. In other words, the distributor collects $5, that the retailer collects $5, the customer comes back and gets $5, the retailer gives back, the distributor gets $5. So I don't see where any money's generated.
Representative Parkinson, the amendments that Representative Keeslin has talked about would not be operating like the bottle bill, at least as I understand it.
No, that's correct.
Okay.
It would in some ways, a simpler system. My second comment is in response to Representative Wehage's concern, that is there environmental harm now occurring from what's going in the landfill? And personally, I don't know the answer to that, and I'll take what Dave Rozelle said at face value, but I don't actually think that the answer to that question necessarily needs to be a driving force to this discussion any more than, say, the question of are scrap aluminum cans or newsprint sitting in landfills causing environmental harm now. They probably aren't, but we have a broader social interest in recovering them for lots of reasons having to do with energy conservation and natural resource conservation. And I would say if we can recover the lead acid in batteries and put it to a productive use in a manner that is not unduly burdensome to any element of society, there is a broad public interest in doing that, even if we don't have any proof about what is happening in groundwater or some other aspect related to landfills. And so I would suggest that we can, that the policy in this bill move forward as good policy, even if we don't have any definitive evidence about groundwater contamination. My final comment is, as someone was asking about the exchange of batteries, I think it was Representative Jones, if you don't intend to buy one, then you can't walk in and get involved in the exchange program. And I was thinking, well, what happens to those then? What if you have three, you're going to buy one, you have two? Well, at least under this system, it would generate some revenue that would go to the state, which, depending on how you decide, could be used for any number of things. And one of those things could be to use some or all that revenue to fund household hazardous waste collection days around the state so that someone who didn't quite fit into this particular system established under this bill perhaps would have an opportunity in some other forum, perhaps once a year or whatever, to bring old batteries and any other household hazardous waste items to a facility and have it properly disposed of or preferably recycled from that point on. So even for those folks not in this particular loop, there are some very real peripheral benefits. So I think it's a good policy, and I hope after the amendments come in that the bill can be moved forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Doug Hyder. Welcome.
Thank Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Doug Hyder, and I represent the Oregon Retail Council. The Oregon Retail Council is a statewide association of retail businesses, and these businesses represent the full spectrum of retailing, from the largest national chain stores to the smallest local single outlet store, and include stores that sell lead-acid batteries. The Oregon Retail Council believes House Bill 3305 is not in the public interest. It is difficult to understand what this bill accomplishes, that House Bill 2333, which is also before you and requires retailers to take batteries back, current practices do not do. Currently, many battery retailers charge a core charge of $3 to $5 if you don't trade in a battery. Some of the largest retail battery retailers charge a core charge if you don't bring in a trade-in. Many of them will also buy junk batteries with a price depending on the market price of scrap lead. In fact, I just looked in the yellow pages of the Salem phone book, and one battery retailer advertises that they will pay premium prices for scrap batteries. The only used batteries this measure would affect that House Bill 2333 would not are batteries labeled after January 1, 1990 that are not traded in. Presumably, these are primarily found in vehicles that wind up in the junkyard, where the junkyard owner must deal with the batteries. Since used batteries have value as scrap and can be sold by the junkyard or anyone else at a variety of retail battery exchanges, these batteries should pose little or no disposal problem. Individuals who purchase batteries where trade-ins are not accepted and are unaware or uninterested in the value of the battery would be accommodated by House Bill 2333 if necessary. The committee believes that's necessary. House Bill 3305 requires the labeling of batteries destined for Oregon distribution, additional bookkeeping on the part of retailers, wholesalers, and manufacturers, policing on the part of the state, and substantial penalties. We believe it is questionable that these additional regulations and burdens on business and the state will achieve any material improvement over present practices, especially if House Bill 2333 is enacted. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Questions?
Well, I just have one, Mr. Hyder.
Go ahead.
What happens when the market for the batteries, for the recycled and used batteries, falls and gets to the point that it's a money loser proposition for the retailers? What happens then?
It's my understanding of the history of the price of lead that we are now, I shouldn't say that, that probably the price of scrap batteries that you can get for a scrap battery if you take it to a retailer is as low as it's ever been. And it's a dollar now. It's been as high as $9, to my understanding. So I don't know of any case, and that isn't to say it didn't happen, but I don't know of any case where lead has no scrap value.
Actually, several years ago, maybe there's more question to the committee, several years ago the price was such that many retailers stopped accepting them because it would actually cost them more to ship it to where it would be recycled than they would get back for it. And it is something that fluctuates. So I don't want to debate the merits of the bill, but there is some of that, and that was one of the things that the bill tries to get at.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kiesling, House Bill 2333 would require that all retailers take batteries back, and if there is a problem there, that might be the solution. We don't think the deposit thing is that much better in resolving the problem than that bill or present practice.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wehage.
Doug, is the main concern here with the Oregon Retail Council that there are a lot of retail outlets that simply don't have the facilities to store incoming used batteries? Or is it more the statement that there are adequate available methods now for recycling?
Well, I think retail council believes there's adequate ways of dealing with it now. As I say, some people advertise currently that they will buy scrap batteries. So if you want to get rid of them, you can. But if there is a problem beyond what current practices resolves, and that could be, then you could require, as in House Bill 23, that retailers take them back. Now, that could pose a problem for some retailers that may not have the storage space to handle them. But most batteries, I believe, are sold through retail operations where they take batteries back, penalize you if you don't bring them in, or pay you for them if they do. Sears, for example, charges you $5 if you don't bring a junk battery in. Battery Exchange, which has outlets all over the state, I believe, will charge you $3 if you don't bring one in. So I suspect that most places that sell large quantities of batteries do take them back, but there's certainly some that don't. Costco, I'm sure, does not. And I don't think they have a space problem, but I don't know.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Janet Jarvis?
I'm going to read to you a prepared statement, and then I'd like to address some of these concerns about the impact on retailers that you've been voicing recently. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Thank you for inviting the Battery Council International, which we'll refer to as the BCI in the future, to provide testimony on legislation regarding the recycling of lead batteries. I'm Jana Jarvis, Manager of Customer Service for Johnson Controls Battery Group, and we're located in Canby, Oregon. I'm speaking to you today as an active member of the Battery Council International. BCI's member companies represent 35 United States manufacturers of lead, both automotive and marine-type batteries. The majority of these batteries are used for starting, lighting, and ignition of motor vehicles and boats. The remainder are used in consumer products and other power applications. BCI members account for approximately 95% or more of the nation's lead battery production. BCI members also represent approximately the same percentage of battery recycling capacity. BCI does endorse legislation that mandates the recycling of lead batteries and strongly supports Oregon's efforts. Recycling lead batteries is environmentally beneficial and economically cost-effective. Most people are surprised to learn that lead batteries and the component plastic parts are 100% recyclable. Today, approximately 80%, and I've heard the number as high as 83% today, of all lead batteries are recycled. The Council believes that lead battery legislation should focus on the remaining 20% of the batteries not making it into the recycling chain, while imposing the least costs upon manufacturers, distributors, retailers, and the consumer. BCI believes that much of House Bill 3305 would be constructive in accomplishing this goal. The Council, however, believes that several of its provisions are unnecessary. Specifically, BCI believes that three of the major provisions of House Bill 3305 by themselves likely will provide sufficient incentives to consumers to return their lead batteries. These provisions are, the first, the prohibition on the land disposal or energy recovery of lead batteries. Secondly, the requirement that all retailers accept junk batteries. And thirdly, the requirement that all persons selling lead batteries post signs stating that it is illegal to discard motor vehicle or other lead batteries, to recycle your used batteries, and that state law requires the acceptance of used motor vehicle or any other lead batteries for recycling. These requirements, which impose minimal costs on consumers, retailers, distributors, and manufacturers, also are contained in BCI's model battery recycling legislation, and a copy of that is appended to the testimony I presented to you. Legislation substantially identical to this model, I might add, has been enacted in California, Wyoming, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, and Florida. BCI does not, however, support the $5 fee requirement outlined in House Bill 3305. The Council believes a fee in lieu of a trade-in does not provide any additional incentive to consumers to return their used batteries. BCI also is concerned that the fee requirement would increase by $1 every 4 years, not to exceed $10, which has been talked about. Just as we oppose fees in general, we see no reason at this point to make a decision to increase these fees over time. Such a decision should rather be revisited in 4 years. BCI also does not support the requirement that the fee be divided between the retailers and the state. Fee-type structures can impose real, unnecessary costs on consumers and retailers and, depending on how they're administered, impose a significant paperwork burden on everyone in the recycling chain, including the implementing state. In fact, fees have been rejected in every state that has enacted battery recycling legislation, with the exception of Rhode Island. A proven battery recycling infrastructure does exist today. Many retailers voluntarily accept junk batteries from their customers for recycling. Experience has shown that when told of the opportunities, consumers will voluntarily trade in used batteries. For this reason, BCI believes that it is unnecessary to impose anything more on the system than the requirements that I've outlined previously. And those three were the prohibition on the land disposal, the requirement that all retailers accept junk batteries, and a requirement that all persons selling lead batteries educate their consumers. Here in Oregon, where the public is so committed to recycling, these requirements likely will be adequate to achieve the goal of 100% lead battery recycling. I respectfully request that a copy of the BCI's model legislation be placed in the record, along with a section-by-section summary of the model and the accompanying battery recycling fact sheet. BCI applauds Representative Kiesling for recognizing the need for battery recycling legislation. The Council supports these efforts and would be happy to work with the legislature on any further developments or with the implementation of this legislation. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Questions? We appreciate your testimony. Thank you very much.
Well, I guess maybe I missed one thing.
Go ahead.
Keep wondering about where we won't have a point of contact. And I guess I discovered one. Used cars get junked out. They have a battery. Mm-hmm. Now, under the proposal as drafted in the bill, you can't exchange that junk battery. The only way you get your $5 back is to exchange it for a new battery. That car doesn't require a new battery.
Well, that's at the retail at the retail level, but there are scrap dealers all over the state that buy used batteries.
They do.
Mm-hmm.
So they wouldn't even come under this bill.
Well, the point that is brought up in this testimony today is that used batteries already have an inherent value in them. There is a market out there, and it's in place. And our primary feeling is that the public needs to be educated as to how to recycle and the importance of the recycling.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
Just one other point. We've heard that it's a cyclical market and that there are times when it dries up because the price of lead or whatever is lower than the cost of recycling. How do we deal with that? Or
well,
is that not correct?
A junk battery always contains some value to a retailer, and they're going to be in the, if they're retailing batteries, they're in that business, and by selling new batteries, that junk value still has an inherent, there is an inherent value in it to them. And the cost, that the total cost of recycling is not borne entirely by the retailer. For example, my company has a policy in place of exchanging new for used batteries. And we bear the cost of transportation and the collection costs associated with the recycling. The retailer doesn't bear that.
Question?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Jones.
Representative Kiesling was commenting about the fluctuation of the market, and I'm curious now because I think he has been given information from whatever source that there is a considerable fluctuation, and we are in fact in a position where now there's value, whereas at times there has not been for the marketplace. Can you comment on that?
Yes. When I started in the battery industry 10 years ago, junk batteries were worth almost $9. In fact, they were worth so much that the people were, there was a large amount of theft because people were stealing them and selling them to scrap dealers. Sort of like the scavenging that goes on with cans and things like that. Today, a junk battery is worth approximately $1.50 to $2, an automotive junk battery. We estimate the total collection cost in the recycling effort to probably be in the range of $2.50. So even today, even though that junk may have value, it would be less than the total cost. And yet, as a manufacturer, it's worth it to us to recycle the lead. I mean, and both economically as well as environmentally. And it's worth it to the retailers to do business that way because they are still collecting a portion of the revenue by selling that junk back to us. So I have not, I've been in the industry 10 years, and what happens typically is when junk prices are very low, wholesalers, more than retailers, will stockpile junks to hold them to sell back when the price is right. You know, they'll either sell them directly to secondary lead smelters or to manufacturers when the price is increased. So there's a variety of kinds of sales that go on when junk prices are low, particularly domestically. Then sometimes you see more exporting.
Yeah. Representative Jones, I have something I'd be happy to furnish the members of the committee. An article appeared in the Eugene Register Guard 2 years ago, or 3 years ago, about scrap metal dealers in Eugene, as an example, refusing to accept batteries because the price had fallen so low, and discussing the problem. I'd be happy to supply that to the committee. And I appreciate what Ms. Jarvis said about today we're in a situation where it's profitable probably for everybody all around.
But during that period of time, retailers were still accepting.
Retailers were still, but the problem that Representative Agron's brought up, which was the junkyard dealer, and that would go through the scrap market, is a problem, and I'd be happy to provide that to the committee.
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
Jana, obviously we're trying to focus in on the last 20% or so of the batteries that aren't getting recycled. And your statement here is that experience has shown that when told of opportunities, consumers will voluntarily trade in used batteries, and I presume your focus then is adding these additional provisions to the law, such as prohibition of land disposal of batteries, as further incentive for people to recycle. Obviously, if they go to the landfill and see a sign that says you may not bring that here, they're going to find some other place. Most people will anyway. They won't find it. I want to focus in on what you said, though, about legislation substantially identical to this model being enacted in these other states. Can you give us some experience as to what's going on in those other states?
Well, unfortunately, most of that legislation is very new as well.
So there's no case history yet?
No, there isn't a great deal of case history in that. One of the, as a personal note, you know, being in the industry, I had a neighbor up the street not too long ago come down and bring me a battery because he figured I could take it back to the plant on my way to work, because he didn't know what to do with it. And he wasn't quite sure, but he didn't think he should put it in his garbage can kind of thing. So I think that our point is that education, for one thing, will help to increase the amount of recycling efforts, as well as the fact that some retailers currently do not accept junk batteries. And by requiring them to accept junk batteries, bringing them into the process and making the process ongoing, that you're going to increase that from 80%, at least a 10%, if not 15%, increase in the very near future. Sears, I do business with Sears, and they have close to, well, they're right at 90% in their recycling efforts. But they've been strongly committed to recycling for many, many years, obviously because that junk battery has some economic value to them.
How long has this other legislation been in place in these other four states?
My understanding, and I don't have a clear answer on that, is that most of the Wyoming, I believe, was just enacted last week or the week before. Minnesota is also recently, and I'm uncertain about the California, Florida.
Thank you.
I don't know. I could apply that for you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your testimony. And at this point, I will close the hearing on House Bill 2333 and House Bill 3305 and open the work session on House Bill 2289. I would ask Gail and if she would come up and Sue Hannah. You might take, if the members would take a look at the March 17th memo you have from our committee administrator. And particularly in reference to the amendments, make reference to here, where people are, and I thought it would be useful. In mind, I think it was the last legislature they asked that this piece of legislation be drawn. The reason for it is that currently state legislation is largely in the section on DHR, and we're now talking about it, putting it in the siting, that is the land use section. And we have a new Federal Housing Act that influences this whole area quite a bit. But I thought at this point, the best way to get at this would be to ask Gail and Sue Hanna if they would go over these amendments for us and tell us where people are and what the issues are, so we can dispose of this bill. Welcome.
Chairman Cease, members of the committee, since the February 17th hearing, four amendments to the bill have been proposed. The majority of parties involved in the drafting of the bill have reached a consensus on these amendments, and I'd like to describe that consensus to you. Amendments 6 and 7 have been combined into one amendment, which is Amendment 9. Section 11.1 of Amendment 9 requires the Department of Human Resources to determine the location and types of residential facilities and facilities such as halfway houses or work release centers, which are subject to the provisions of ORS 169-690. Section 11 sub 2 of Amendment 9 requires the Department of Human Resources, prior to issue a license for a residential facility, to determine the number and type of residential facilities.
Is made. Is it made to DHR, or is it made to the city or county for a residential facility site?
An application, Mr. Chairman, Representative, an application is generally made to the agency for whom the program is going to be licensed and contracted for. So in our case, the application for, say, a new residential program for people with developmental disabilities would come both to the county, because we contract our services through community mental health programs. So the license would be submitted primarily to the state with a copy to the county.
What I'm trying to figure out, what exactly could be done with this information other than to suggest to somebody that maybe it's inappropriate to decide at this location because there's two or three other facilities within three blocks. It sounds to me like that's about it, that you don't have any real control. If somebody comes in and makes an application for a site, you might be able to pull out your map if we follow the provisions of this bill and say, well, there's already four sites in that area, why don't you find someplace else? And their response might be, but I want this site.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, speaking in terms of how the Mental Health Division does business, ultimately we have the control because we contract for the dollars. So we ultimately have the decision on whether or not to license a program in a particular area. It's not simply someone decides to open shop and submits a license and we have to grant it no matter what. It's a programmatic and a fiscal decision, and that's true for most other agencies within the department as well.
Thank you. That's what I was looking for.
Thank you very much. Would you comment on the number 8? What's the impact of the 8 amendments?
Mr. Chairman, what's commonly referred to as the Dorelli legislation is something that the department and our division has never liked, because it sets up some arbitrary quotas that are driven in part by a complex institution type of formula. We understand clearly why the City of Salem and Marion County supports that. I think the department had even proposed before the session to propose legislation to repeal it, but because of considerable local political pressure, withdrew that. We believe that the Dorelli legislation can run us afoul of the Fair Housing Amendments, but our feeling was that's not a land use issue as this is, and we didn't want to cloud this particular bill, which we think is a good bill, with that issue, but we're still studying that one as well.
Well, let me ask you so I get it clear then, because I think this has been confusing. We're dealing here with this bill with a land use issue, which is a siting question. Number 9 relates to that. What you're saying is number 8 really is not a land use issue, and if eight has merit, and I'm not arguing whether it has merit or not, it probably ought to be in the DHR section and not in this particular bill.
Correct. Mr. Chairman, the dash 8 does not deal with siting issues at all. It's a volume type of issue on how many people in certain categories can receive services in a certain county based on a ratio of numbers of persons that have been deinstitutionalized. It's a very complex formula, but it's not a siting issue. It's a volume in terms of program capacity in a certain county of the state.
Well, you're saying then that the material in number 8 really is not an appropriate item before this committee?
Mr. Chairman, I think so. It doesn't really fit with this legislation. In discussing that issue with our attorneys from the Attorney General's office, she also indicated there's many other issues that over time we're going to have to look at vis-a-vis the Fair Housing Amendment, some real estate laws, covenants, other things of that sort. So I think certainly this legislation will not be the ultimate cure-all for any problems we might have with fair housing, and that's certainly true of the Dash 9 issue. Dash 8.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your testimony. Come on up. Well, I don't think her amendment has been trashed. I think the point making is probably doesn't fit this bill, but because it really relates to DHRs. I understand what the desire here is to take the siting issue, the land use and zoning issue out of DHR, and put in land use, and that's why we've got it, but that this bill, this amendment probably belongs back with the rest of it. But go ahead so we get the testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janice Starr. I'm the executive director of the Association for Retarded Citizens of Oregon. The potential repeal of the Durelli statute was entered into this bill simply because this bill, as you know, has been a very long process of development, and after the Fair Housing Act was passed, we had the sense that the parties involved would like to be very careful that the Fair Housing Act is complied with. And while the Durelli formula may not be a siting or zoning issue per se, it does relate to the discrimination issues regarding where a person might live or might not live. I think, as Mr. Tate said, that we will clearly run afoul of the Fair Housing Act with this, as we may with Dash 9 amendments to this bill. 2289 is an excellent bill. I do feel that I agree with Ms. Clark and Mr. Caves that it's cleared up a lot of things that we need to do in the state of Oregon, and our attempt was just to further clean up the statutes that deal with the same subject. I feel a little bit like we're passing the buck if we just take it out, take the amendments out and say that it doesn't belong in a particular forum, because it clearly relates to where people live and where they're allowed to live or not allowed to live. And I think any time we set up a mechanism for segregating in any way, we can't read people's minds and say, is this for the purpose of segregation or not for the purpose of segregation? When we open the door to limiting where people can live who are protected as a protected class under the Fair Housing Act, we're opening ourselves up to problems.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you for your testimony.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Jones.
Did you have an opportunity in some other forum to address this subject? Or is this the only opportunity that you think you have at this point in the session?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jones, we didn't think it was inappropriate to bring it up in terms of relating to this bill, and it was accepted by Legislative Council as relating to this topic. I don't know if there is an opportunity in some other forum. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, bills are all over being introduced now.
Representative Jones. I would say that if we don't consider it here, and I have some real questions whether it belongs in this particular section, that I would ask the Representative Kotulski, Chair of the Human Resources Committee, to take a look at this, because I think that's where it belongs. And it's, I'm not making an issue on the merits of it. I just, since what we're trying to do here is get some of this legislation out of the DHR section into land use where it belongs, I think we've complicated it if we now put what should be in DHR over in the land use. So I think we've got that particular problem.
Thank you.
Your testimony. Thank you very much. At this point, then, we have two proposed amendments. We have everybody here, so let's move, I guess. On 2289, Dash 9 is compromised. Dash 8 is a question in reference to where it belongs. Do I have a motion on 2289-9?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. no parking.
I'd move amendments 2289-9 into the bill.
Is there any objection to accepting dash 9 as an amendment to the bill?
Mr. Chairman, it appears as though on line 11 there is an additional markup. I guess it's ORS 169 instead of 167.
Yes, 169, and we'll note that. It's not 167, it's 169.
I think that corrected?
It should be corrected on this, on some corrected on my sheet.
Oh, not on mine.
It's
169.
Procedural question?
Yes.
I guess I don't remember. Have we adopted any other amendments previously?
No, we have not. Not on this bill.
Thank you.
Okay, that's 169.690. Any objection to dash 9 then with that correction? Not, we'll accept that. What is your wish on the dash 8 amendments? Is it all agreeable if I talk to Representative Tulsky about that and see what we can work with that through that committee? Yes, Representative Jones.
Mr. Chair, was there anyone else who wished to testify on that issue, or was that the extent of the people that were here on that
issue? I don't know. Is anybody else who wants to give testimony? I didn't think so. I think we took everybody.
All right.
Is that agreeable to the committee? Let me do that then. Do I then have a motion on 2289 as amended?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House Bill 2289 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Okay, it's been moved that 2289 as amended go to the floor with the due pass. Is there any comment or question? If not, if the Secretary will call the roll.
Representative Jones?
Aye.
Representative Kiesling?
Aye.
Vice Chairman Parkinson?
Aye.
Representative Pickard?
Aye.
Representative Wehage?
Aye.
Representative Agrons?
Aye.
Representative Dix?
Aye.
Representative Hostica?
Aye.
Chairman Cease?
Aye. The bill passes. I can't resist a comment on this bill. There's been a lot of people involved with it, and they spent a lot of hours. We've ended up with a tiny little amendment. But I would say it is an indication, and maybe a little case study, of what happens when you get into these things. A lot more people know about this issue now than they did when they started. So that you, and we have, I think, a pretty good bill and an amendment, and there are a couple of other issues that ARC is interested in, and I will help you with those issues. So I think all in all, it's probably not a bad day's work for the bill. So we're willing to close the work session on House Bill 2289 and open the work session on Senate Bill 39.
We have new amendments on this?
Yes.
We have.
Right, well,
okay.
Let me try to see if we can't get rid of this, and then we can adjourn.
Here's 39. What about that?
I thought going to have questions.
Which one are we on?
Let me ask Mike Graney to come up and Mark Nelson on Senate Bill 39.
What she tries to do is some.
Yeah, that's going around.
Now, on this bill, Carol, you may remind us, we have adopted two amendments, I believe, on Senate Bill 39. We probably ought to be brought up to date on that. We did adopt another amendment where there was some conflict, I think Amendment Dash 11.
Right.
It turned out there was some sort of mechanical problem with that, in addition to, I think, the substantive conflict.
Right.
And but before we look at that, Carol, why don't you tell us what 1 and 2 are so that we have...
Well, you did that very well, I must say. That's about
and
it.
By the way, we do have coffee now.
Yes, we do have coffee. We had Senate Bill, this committee had Senate Bill 39. I've written this little memo where it says that we accepted, let me see where I am. Good Lord.
Dash 10.
We dashed it 10, and we did go ahead also adopted Dash 11. However, so let me talk the amendments. So Dash 10, Dash 11 were adopted. There is a new 14 that you have before you, which Representative Cease and the Department of Energy have prepared for your consideration, which addresses some of the questions, but not all, of Dash 11. So... then, because we did discover that the Dash 11 are basically inconsistent as to what they intended to get out, I did talk to Ramona to find out what we could do as a body with what we've already done. And she said to me that really, as long as you've got the bill and you haven't passed it out of the committee, you can do whatever you want.
What I would suggest you do, since I think there is a problem with this, so that we know what we're doing,
whatever.
If I would accept a motion from one of you who voted on the prevailing side, well, I guess since the time of all these, to rescind our action on all three amendments and then start from scratch so we know what we're doing.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jones.
Is there a reason to rescind all of the amendments?
Well, the first two maybe not, but I think it would be clearer.
I see somebody going like this.
Yeah, I think it'd be clearer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, they worked on them, I think, for the past several days. The groups have come together and done this and that and the other, and it's so messy now that it would appear to me that it makes sense just to recede from all the amendments we made the other day and start over.
I'd agree with that. I think we'd do better.
I'd make that motion, Mr. Chairman.
I'll make the motion. move then that we rescind our action on the three amendments to date. Is there any objection to that? If not, let's do that. And
we're now with a clean slate.
We're now with a clean slate. Right.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a question?
Yes.
The dash 14 amendments that we have before us, do these incorporate the dash 10 amendments and the dash 11, or just what do they consist of in historical terms?
Historical? Meaning
historical.
Most recent
historical. Go ahead, Mike.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Mike Graney from the Oregon Department of Energy. Representative Agron's, the A14 amendments only address three specific questions that City of Klamath Falls raised. So the A10 amendments do respond both to request by the Ways and Means Committee to have a cap on the Trojan emergency response fee. They also incorporate some technical amendments that Pacific and PGE requested regarding how we document our billing, and they do incorporate a request by City of Klamath Falls to clarify that the bill is prospective only.
Okay,
so when we would get to the consideration of the bill, I would be asking the committee to adopt the A10 amendments and the A14, but not the A11.
So we're not walking by the A10s. The slate is clean and there isn't anything in it now, but we would want to repass the A10, which at this point are non-controversial, right?
That's Mr. Chairman,
well, Mr. Chairman, may I take the liberty
of
moving the passage of the amendment of the bill to include the LC 30, the Senate Bill 39 amendments designated A10.
All right, let's make sure that everybody has been moved to adopt dash 10, which is the everybody agrees to that.
No problem
with that. And that's the I think the upper limit on the amount, isn't it?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Upper limit on the amount, dash 10. Everyone has a copy of dash 10 in front of you.
Mr. Chair, I have dash 10. As I recall, we just rescinded it.
We just rescinded it, but we're starting over.
That's all right, but is it the exact same form?
Yes,
the
exact same form. No change at all.
No change.
We're just starting from scratch, and it's suggesting now a recommendation of Representative Agamemnon that we now start over and accept number 10.
So then we'll just lay that aside.
Anyone disagree or have any arguments with number 10?
Before we do this, I'm just glancing back and forth between A14. Are we going to have A14 explained to us?
We're going to have all of them explained to us. We'll take them one by one so we know what we have before we get through.
Okay.
Then we're going to finish it, put it out, and we're going to adjourn. Go home and you'll ain't touch your morning. All right, we have accepted number 10. All right.
Okay.
All right, now, do we have any other amendments where we have any agreement at this point, or are the rest of them in disagreement?
Mr. Chairman, the A14 amendments represent agreement on two of the three points that City of Klamath Falls raised the other day.
What are those two?
Again, these issues only deal with the site application process. They don't go into the broader issues of the bill regarding Trojan emergency response or regulatory costs of existing facilities. But the city raised concerned that there was no process for establishing fees for site applications. We've agreed on wording that would direct the siting council to establish by order fees for the different types of energy facilities for which it would issue site certificates. But do that every other year or more frequently if necessary. And it would give the applicant notice and required additional documentation if our costs were to exceed that fee schedule, but the applicant still would be required to pay the full cost even if they exceeded that schedule. There was a drafting error, and I think we left out one sentence that Mr. Nelson's going to bring up, and we would support inclusion of that sentence as part of those amendments.
What is the sentence?
Have A14 amendments on it's on page 3, line 27, where it's talking about the establishment of the fee schedule. The sentence should be included that says fees will be based upon actual historical costs incurred by the council and department in reviewing similar site applications. And
that is included in line 27?
No, that's what they want included.
That's in addition.
Let me ask you, though, that would be here right after budget?
Yes, sir.
Read it again,
would you do it slowly?
Again. It's a new sentence to be added?
New sentence to be added.
Yeah.
Yes. It says fees will be based upon actual historical costs.
All right, take it. Will be based
upon actual
actual historical costs
incurred by the council.
Okay.
And department in reviewing similar site applications.
Finesse? Fees will be based upon actual historical costs incurred by the council and department in reviewing similar site applications.
Yes, sir.
Right. That's agreeable between.
Yes,
all right. Everybody know where that appears then on line 27, page 3, after the word budget, and the next sentence which begins with you have this other sentence added. Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I just have a clarifying question. What if the what's being requested has never, it's unprecedented, has never before been, where is that spoken to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kiesling, I think the remaining sentences in this section give us the flexibility to determine appropriate fees for schedule, particularly the last line of the page 3 where it talks about other appropriate variables having an effect on the expense of evaluation. So I'm comfortable that that language gives the council the necessary flexibility, but also requires us to make a good faith effort at estimating costs based on real world experience, and that we cannot be arbitrary in establishing those fees.
All right, let me ask you another item on this amendment, Michael. On page 4, is the parent, subparent 3 to be out?
Yes, sir. And that's the second point on which the city had raised a concern, in which we agree. The city had raised a concern about the department or the council's expenses, legal expenses on appeal and defending a siting council decision. You can say there were not a lot of other site certificate or energy facility holders who were terribly excited about paying our attorney's fees, and we'd request that that language be dropped as well. And with other deletions in the A14 amendment, specifically on page 2, where it right at the top of the page, line 2, it says deletes lines 15 and 16. That takes out the reference to attorney's fees for defending a siting council decision. And it's my understanding the city agrees with that as well. The third issue the city raised concerns about.
Repeat that, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman. Michael, somebody else had my ear for a moment.
Okay. On page 2 of the A14 amendments, where on line 2, actually lines 2, 3, and 4, the deletions there that are described there, combined with the eliminating of the paragraph on page 4 that you had referred to, eliminate all the references to attorney's fees for defending a citing counsel decision.
So 2, 3, and 4 should be deleted?
No.
No, they do delete in the bill. They direct where in the bill deletions occur. And that takes care of the city's second concern.
All right, so the only changes then in this dash 14 are the adding of the one sentence and the deletion of sub 3 on page 4.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Yes, sir.
And that's agreeable. Jeanette, come up a minute. Let me ask you something, will you?
Chair,
Representative Jones,
would you get Mark to identify himself? I don't think anybody on the tape afterwards knows who the nod is.
Oh, it's Mark Nelson.
Mark Nelson, Public Affairs Council, nodding. Representing City of Klamath Falls.
He's not going to sleep. He's just been saying yes. Let me ask you, Jeanette. Carol has given you this dash 14 amendment to Senate Bill 39, I'm giving you the sentence we want to add on the bottom of page 2, line 27.
On 3?
Page 3. Page 3. On line 27, in the middle of the sentence, between budget and D, would be the sentence, fees will be based upon actual historical cost incurred by the council and department in reviewing similar site applications. Is there any problem mechanically that we accept that, is there? No, everybody knows what it is.
Jeanette Holman, Legislative Council. Mr. Chairman, no problem mechanically.
Okay. All right. Then number 14 with those two amendments is agreeable to the two parties.
Well, not entirely, Mr. Chairman. Okay. There was a third issue, and that was the issue of to what extent an applicant should reimburse other state agencies that the Siting Council requests assist in the review of the application.
But is that in 14?
That is also in 14. And that is in 14 on page 1, basically from line 3 through the rest of the page. What I have offered there, and we came very close but not reach total agreement on, was language that further limits and restricts other state agencies beyond the language that we had showed you the other day in the dash A12 amendments. Specifically, the concern the city had was that this not be an open-ended invitation for other state agencies, particularly those that might not be neutral, to participate in the Siting Council proceeding and then bill the applicant in addition to being opposed to the proceeding. What I have offered is that language clarifying in the statute that the council cannot compensate a state agency for expenses relating to that agency's review of the notice of intent or application or the agency's participation in the council proceeding unless the council makes a specific finding that it does not have the information that it needs to complete the council's statutory evaluation of the application, so that the council would have to make a finding that it does not have the resources or information and that it requires that state agency's assistance. The state agency, in turn, would be limited in what it could bill through the council to the applicant for only those expenses related to that specific issue. And if that agency or other agencies wish to intervene in the Siting Council proceeding, they would be doing that at their own expense. That is substantially more strict than both current law and the A12 amendments. And I think it meets the city's concerns, but we did not reach agreement.
100%. Is the difference that the, Mark, do you want this to be sure that this is an independent contractor, not another state agency? Is that the difference?
No, Mr. Chairman, if I could comment on the amendments. You have before you amendments to Senate Bill 39A-, they're dated March 17th. These are the amendments that we drafted and are incorporated in their entirety in the dash 14 amendments, with the exception of the sentence that starts in the middle of 3A that starts out studies authorized by this section. On page one of the amendment dated March 17th, 1989, City of Klamath Falls.
Everything else would be in 14, but that...
Everything else is in 14 except that. Now, Mr. Chairman, the city believes that we offered the fee schedule, came off the budgetary language, which we were proposing last week, and we came off the cap requirement. And we went to the fee schedule because we thought that was coming partway in terms of the agreement. The department, in turn, agreed to the attorney fee issue. The issue here is whether or not other state agencies who do not have statutory authority to bill for review of a notice of intent or application should be able to collect through the Department of Energy for that work that they are required either permissively or mandatorily to do in review of hydroelectric applications. Our feeling is that if a particular state agency like Fish and Wildlife wants to be reimbursed for the work they do in reviewing an application, that they should put a bill in that authorizes the collection of fees for that purpose. And Mike is correct. This language has been tightened up so that the council must approve. But right now, under this bill, whether we had that specific language, the council, we would assume, or the department would approve of another study that a department might make. Maybe they would not. But from our point of view, that when Fish and Wildlife comes to the Department of Energy and says, by God, we absolutely, and they're opposed to a hydroelectric project, they say, by God, we have to do this study. That council generally is going to approve that study. And the applicant, under his language, is going to have to pay for that study. Under the language that we have put together, we said in sub 2 that FSEC shall not compensate a state agency for expenses related to the agency's review of a notice of intent or an application. Then we came in with an out because Mike had said, well, what if we wanted to go to the University of Oregon and they want to do a biological study or something like that? So in 3A, we said, notwithstanding subsection 2 of this section, the council may enter into contractual agreements with state agencies to perform specific studies. Portland State, U of O, some other state agency that is not charged under statute with reviewing a hydroelectric application. But then we come back and say, if you are charged under statute with reviewing a hydroelectric application, you cannot charge the applicant for that review unless you go get specific statutory authority for that agency, whether it be Fish or Wildlife, DEQ, Water Resources, to charge. We just don't want to see the Department of Energy being a filter for these other agencies who come and pile on with study requests on an application.